Shri Srimad's Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Santa Gaura Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. All glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Sri Guru and Sri Guru. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pasai Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamani Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Vacharani Nirvishesha Srinivani Vaskachari Sijarani. So we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, called The Three Modes of Material Nature. And we'll do verse 6 today, but I'm first going to read just the first few verses so that we can kind of get the context of this verse. And again, I would also like to, we had a few visitors today, again, extend my welcome. So nice to have you here with us. So we read regularly from the Bhagavad Gita, which most of you are familiar with. It's an ancient Vedic literature, over 5,000 years old. And our spiritual masters, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, wrote the English translations and commentaries. So that is what we're reading from today. I'll just read the verses for the first five verses. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Again, I shall declare to you the supreme wisdom, the best of all knowledge, knowing which all the sages have attained supreme perfection. By becoming fixed in this knowledge, one can attain to the transcendental nature like my own. Thus established, one is not born at the time of creation or disturbed at the time of dissolution. The total material substance called Brahman is the source of birth, and is that Brahman that I impregnate, making possible the births of all living beings, O son of Bharata." Text 4, "It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father. 5, material nature consists of three modes, goodness, passion, and ignorance. When the eternal living entity comes in contact with nature, O mighty armed Arjuna, he becomes conditioned by these modes." So now text 6, Krishna will begin to tell Arjuna about the mode of goodness. You have it up there? Okay. Maybe we can just repeat it once. Tatra sattvam nirmalatvat prakashakam anamayam sukha sangena bannati jnana sangena chanaga. So the translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. O sinless one, the mode of goodness, being purer than the others, is illuminating, and it frees one from all sinful reactions. Those situated in that mode become conditioned by a sense of happiness and knowledge. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The living entities conditioned by material nature are of various types. One is happy, another is very active, another is helpless. Of course, those are the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. All these types of psychological manifestations are causes of the entity's conditioned status in nature. How they are differently conditioned is explained in this section of the Bhagavad Gita. The mode of goodness is first considered. The effect of developing the mode of goodness in the material world is that one becomes wiser than those otherwise conditioned. A man in the mode of goodness is not so much affected by material miseries, and he has a sense of advancement in material knowledge. The representative type is the Brahmin, who is supposed to be situated in the mode of goodness. The sense of happiness is due to understanding that in the mode of goodness, one is more or less free from sinful reactions. Actually, in the Vedic literatures, it is said that the mode of goodness means greater knowledge and a greater sense of happiness. Well, so far, so good. The mode of goodness sounds like a very wonderful thing and a good place to be situated. But now Srila Prabhupada, in the second paragraph, will explain the problem. The difficulty here is that when a living entity is situated in the mode of goodness, he becomes conditioned to feel that he has advanced in knowledge and is better than others. In this way, he becomes conditioned. The best examples are the scientist and the philosopher. Each is very proud of his knowledge, and because they generally improve their living conditions, they feel a sort of material happiness. The sense of advanced happiness in conditioned life makes them bound by the motive goodness of material nature. As such, they are attracted toward working in the mode of goodness, and as long as they have attraction for working in this way, they have to take some type of body in the modes of nature. Thus, there is no likelihood of liberation or being transferred to the spiritual world. Repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, a scientist, or a poet, and repeatedly become entangled in the same disadvantages of birth and death. But due to the illusion of material energy, one thinks that sort of life is pleasant. Om Gyanatvarandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chakshulimitamina Tasma Shigrave Namaha Vanchakalpa Chubhishcha Kripa Sindhubhibhicha Patitano Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So Srila Prabhupada is pointing out that while the mode of goodness may be very desirable from some perspectives and is certainly represents advancement over the lower modes of ignorance and passion, which will next be discussed within the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, there is a difficulty. And that difficulty, even though it appears to be a favorable position, is that one becomes conditioned to that very happiness that one achieves, and thus becomes entangled still within this material world. In Srila Prabhupada's purport, he says, the difficulty is the living entity is situated in the mode of goodness, becomes conditioned to feel he is advanced in knowledge. The sense of advanced happiness and conditioned life makes them bound by the goodness of material nature. And as long as they have an attraction for working that way, they have to take some type of body in the modes of nature. So even though this is an advanced stage of life, and Prabhupada gives the prototypes of the Brahman, and then of course more in the Western world, we see scientists, philosophers, poets, people who may have some advancement in knowledge, they may be leading even a fairly good life. But the fact is that they still are connected with this material world. And as long as one is connected within this material world, one has to suffer within this material world. Now, of course, if one is situated in the mode of goodness, there's more happiness. There is certainly more happiness and less distress experienced. But we know that in the material world, there is always some degree of happiness and distress. And we also know that whatever happiness that is here is temporary. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, when Krishna begins to instruct Arjuna on the basics of the philosophy, right in the beginning, he first, of course, instructs Arjuna that you're not your body, that you transmigrate through different bodies from one species of life to another, but yet you retain that same eternality of the soul. He said, but then in verse 14, it says right away that one must learn to tolerate the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress. So even this happiness that one obtains in the mode of goodness is temporary. And one must learn to tolerate that in the same way that we tolerate distress or suffering in this material world. So this is the nature of this material world. The Shashvatam, the Kaliyam, Shashvatam, that it is a place of misery and it is temporary. Nothing will last, even that happiness or that goodness that one may experience. So we know that due to one's good karma, one may experience a certain degree of a high standard of living or even a heavenly planet. But when that karma is used up, one again falls down into this material world, to the lower species of life, or to the lower modes of nature. In a purport in the 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th chapter, text 30, Srila Prabhupada says, this material energy gives living entities what appears to be an opportunity to be happy within this material world, but that is Maya. In other words, it is a dream that is never to be fulfilled. So we tend to have an illusion of happiness within this material world. And in fact, that happiness is real. We can't deny that there is a certain amount of happiness in the mode of goodness. The Bhagavad Gita is stating that there is. But at the same time, we understand, first of all, that it's illusory. We understand that it's temporary, that it cannot last, and it is not the ultimate goal of life, most importantly. So, all of these modes of nature, all of this material energy is working directly under Krishna. Krishna is in control, says in the ninth chapter, Mayadakshena Prakriti Suitesa Chatra Etunanena Kuntaya Jagad Viparavartate. This material nature, which is one of my energies, is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, producing all moving and unmoving beings. Under its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. So this material nature, this Maya, these modes of nature, are not something separate from Krishna. They are his energy, and they are working under his direction. You know, but they are working according to the desires of the living entity. Without the desire of the living entity towards enjoyment in this material world, there would be no need for this material creation at all. So Krishna creates this material world really because of the misdirected desire of the living entity. But at the same time, Krishna stays situated within the heart and directs the living entities. 1861, Krishna says, the Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of material energy. So according to the desires, Krishna is fulfilling the desire of the living entity. So if we have desires that are more in the mode of goodness, more in the mode of passion, more in the mode of ignorance, Krishna fulfills those, and we get the appropriate body, and both gross body and subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego, that is appropriate to fulfill that particular desire. So we see there are countless varieties within this material world. There are so many different varieties of bodies, 8,400,000 species of life, including 400,000 different human forms of life. I've never quite figured out what those are, but I understand that sometimes even, probably one said even like apes and monkeys are considered part of the human species of life, because if you actually look at them, they're, you know, amazingly, if you look at the monkeys in India, you know, they're very, very clever, aren't they? Very intelligent, and you can see how they act like children almost, you know. So at any rate, there's so many different species of life to fulfill the desires of living entities, and of course there are the different interactions of these modes of nature. The modes of goodness, the modes of passion, and modes of ignorance interact, and Prabhupada describes they interact, you know, 3 × 3 × 3 again, so that there's actually 81 different interactions, 9 × 9, 81 different interactions of the three modes of nature. And of course there are the 26 elements, and at any rate, between all of this interaction of material nature, so many varieties are manifest. So everybody acts according to their very specific mode of nature. It's not just as simple as you're in the mode of ignorance or passion or goodness. In other words, there's a very, almost an infinite variety. And so we see that there are so many different, you know, interests, so many different personalities, so many different ways that people behave within this material world, which of course reflects the infinite variety which is there in the spiritual world. This material world being a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, we see the same types of things. So everyone has to act according to their nature. And Krishna, seated within the heart as the super soul, is directing the wanderings of those living entities to act according to their nature. So this need for countless variety is there in living entity. And we see this, that people have to have so much variety. There's so many different interests that people have. And we see that people keep themselves busy in this material life because they're not so much interested in spiritual life or serving Krishna, serving God. They tend to amuse themselves with so many hobbies, sports, collections, right? I mean, there's just the variety is just growing and growing. I just out of amusement, once I just out of interest, I checked on eBay and they had over 500 different categories of collectibles. You know, just different categories of, you know, if you want to collect whatever. I just glanced through one, and there's a category called antiques, and one of the categories is barn doors, and there's 328 items right there on eBay that you can bid on, different kinds of barn doors, and there's different categories, wood barn doors, steel barn doors, etc., that people collect, apparently. I mean, I'm giving kind of a, maybe a ridiculous example, but it's not that ridiculous because, you know, people have to occupy their cells with something. And according to their different modes of nature, they're very specific, you know, bodily, psycho, you know, situation in life, their mind, current their mind and their psychology, everybody, you know, has some unique or particular or peculiar interest that they pursue. You can see on the internet, there's a forum for everything, isn't there? Every possible interest, there's some forum, there's some group, you can go on to onto so many things. So without this variety, what would happen? We would become very quickly tired of this material life, wouldn't we? In other words, if there was just you know, one thing on eBay and there was only you know, one type of person and everything was, we would very soon lose interest because variety is part of the nature of the soul. So we see that people quickly tire of things. They have to go from one thing to another to try to find this, to find satisfaction. First of all, variety is the nature of the soul, so we're all looking for that. But we're also looking for certain things. There are certain things that we're all looking for which are part of our nature as pure spirit souls. We all have a relationship, a loving relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we try to find that. We try to imitate that. We try to simulate that somehow or another in this material life. So in personal relationships, people are always looking for that perfect relationship. They're usually disappointed because that perfect relationship only exists in our relationship with Krishna and the spiritual master. So therefore, people go from one relationship to another. They're thinking that there's going to be more and more somehow some satisfaction somewhere else. It's kind of interesting. Of course, you know, I study these things and I'm involved in, you know, different groups, but the research on marriage and divorce is interesting because, you know, we throw out figures like 50% of marriages end in divorce, and that's not exactly, it's not totally accurate, but it's close enough. Somewhere around that, let's just say, for sake of argument, 50% marriages end in divorce. So now you would think when people get married for the second time, they're older, right? They're a little smarter. They know it didn't work. So probably they're much more successful in the second marriage, right? No. No, second marriages have about a 70% divorce rate. And if you go to third marriages, it's 80 or 90%. So in other words, people don't really learn. They're just, you know, they're desperately seeking some happiness and looking for this variety. This person didn't please me. Somebody else, it's nothing wrong with me or my relationship. In other words, look for somebody who's going to give me that satisfaction or that happiness I'm looking for. And as we say, I think there's a song or something that said, looking for love in all the wrong places, which is exactly what we're doing because our real loving relationship is with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But it's not unexpected that we're seeking these things, that we're looking for all of these different amusements or looking for all this variety, because that's the nature of the soul. It is one of the qualities of spiritual life, that there is endless variegatedness, infinite variety is there in the spiritual world. Krishna's pastimes are infinite. They're endless. They go on forever. It's described that Anantasesha, who holds Lord Vishnu, that he has thousands of mouths and he's reciting the pastimes of Krishna and he never says the same pastime twice. And he goes on for millions of years with endlessly new variety of pastimes talking about Krishna. So everything that is here in the material world is there in perfection in the spiritual world. We see a lot of variety in this material world because there is tremendous variety in the spiritual world. We see that there are relationships in this material world. We look for those relationships. It's the nature of the soul to seek and to find and to enjoy those relationships. This is our constitutional service, to have eternal activity, a devotional service. So in our constitutional position of devotional service, one never becomes bored. We don't become jaded. We don't become complacent. We're not always looking for something else, because devotional service, service to the Lord, brings that greatest satisfaction, the satisfaction of the soul, and brings about real happiness, that ananda, that bliss that we are actually looking for. There's a very, very wonderful, probably most of you are familiar with it, a very nice verse in purport from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 4th canto, chapter 30, text 20. This is Lord Vishnu speaking to the Prachetas. Lord Vishnu, Krishna, Supreme Personality of Godhead, says, always engaging in the activities of devotional service, devotees feel ever increasingly fresh and new in all of their activities. The all-knower, the super soul within the heart of the devotee, makes everything increasingly fresh. And I won't read the whole purport, but parts of it. Srila Prabhupada says, a devotee is inspired by the super soul within the heart to advance in devotional service in a variety of ways. The devotee does not feel hackneyed or stereotyped, nor does he feel he is in a stagnant position. In the material world, if one engages in chanting a material name, he will feel tired after chanting a few times. However, one can chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra all day and night and never feel tired. As chanting is increased, it will come out new and fresh. Srila Rupa Goswami said that if he could somehow get millions of ears and tongues, then he could relish spiritual bliss by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. There is nothing uninspiring for a highly advanced devotee. In the heart of the devotee, Krishna reveals himself as ever increasingly new. Being inspired by him, the devotee experiences increased transcendental bliss in the execution of his devotional service. So that real variety, that real happiness that we're seeking is there in the spiritual world. Prabhupada once talked about the impersonalists or the Mayavadis who want to become one with the Lord, to merge into the Brahma-jyoti, into the white light, into the spiritual effulgence of the Lord. And what happens to those? One has to be very advanced to do this. One has to be free from material desires. One has to be a transcendentalist to achieve this position of attaining the Brahma-jyoti, that spiritual white light that's the emanation of the body of the Lord. So what happens to those people? What happens to those people who achieve that? They stay for some time and they eventually fall back to this material world. Why? The simple answer is they get bored. It's not quite that simple. But in other words, that lack of variety, that lack of relationship, a person, we cannot sustain that. And even one who is a highly advanced transcendentalist cannot really be happy or satisfied in that state where there's not activity, where there's not service, where there's not love, where there is not this eternal variety that we find in the spiritual world. So that is what makes the devotees really happy. That is what makes all of us really happy. We need to transcend all the modes of nature. We can't simply stay and remain within the mode of goodness and get that relief from material misery that's there from bhakti, from the chanting of the holy name. What happens when we begin to chant the holy name is there's actually a change of body. There's actually a purification of the heart that comes about, and it makes us lose interest in this material world. This is a verse in the purport from Srimad Bhagavatam 5.135. My dear king, a devotee who has taken shelter of the dust from the lotus feet of the Lord can transcend the influence of the six material whips, hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, old age, and death, and he can conquer the mind and the five senses. However, this is not very wonderful for a pure devotee of the Lord, because even a person beyond the jurisdiction of the four castes, in other words, an untouchable, is immediately relieved of bondage to material existence if he utters the holy name of the Lord even once. Srila Prabhupada says, because of the material body, every living entity in material existence is disturbed by these sadguna, six whips, hunger, thirst, lamentation, illusion, and validity in death. Not to speak of a sanctified devotee, even an outcast is immediately freed from material bondage if he utters the holy name of the Lord once. When a person, even though a chandala, is initiated by a pure devotee into the chanting of the holy name of the Lord, his body changes as he follows the instructions of the spiritual master. Although sometimes we cannot see the gross body changing, chanting the holy name of the Supreme Lord immediately changes the subtle body, and because the subtle body changes, the living entity is immediately free from material bondage. So we know that we have this gross body made of the five material elements of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And we also have the subtle body of mind, intelligence, and ego. Krishna explains this in the first few verses of the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And of course, he says, beyond the subtle body is the soul itself, and this controller of all of these is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But the subtle body is interesting because the soul actually is carried on the subtle body. When we transmigrate from one body to another, the soul actually is carried on the subtle body, and the subtle body is conditioned, you know, to the body that one is going into. You know, so the consciousness becomes influenced by that subtle body. And this is what Prabhupada is talking about here, that there is a change that comes about when we start to chant the holy name of the Lord. There's a purification and a change of body, but it first starts with the subtle body. The sort of the rule of material nature is things go from subtle to gross. So there's changes in the subtle body, then those manifest as subtle as changes to the gross body. So the changes that occur are with our consciousness. The consciousness changes through the chanting of the holy name. We say the consciousness becomes purified. Why is it purified? Because it's in contact with the Supreme Pure. God is the Supreme Pure. God is none different than his holy name. When we're in contact with the holy name, we are in contact with the Supreme Pure and thus become purified. So our senses, our mind, our intelligence, and our ego become purified. So the subtle bodies, of course, mind, intelligence, and ego. And these become purified. It's described that the mind is the best friend of the living entity or the worst enemy. For the conditioned soul, the mind is usually the worst enemy. What the mind does is takes the sensory information from the five senses and the working senses, all the information, and it's sort of funneled to the mind. The mind is the sort of the checkpoint, and its job, Prabhupada says, is accepting and rejecting. I like this, I don't like this, I want this, I don't want this. Okay, so I say, I want this, this looks good to eat. So then, intelligence is what figures out how to go about and do it. Yeah, it's your strategic planner. Your intelligence figures out, yes, this is a good thing to do, I think, and yeah, we'll go ahead and do that, and good plan, mind, and goes ahead. So the intelligence is ahead of the mind. Now, when the intelligence is materially contaminated, it's simply carrying out the ways to that the mind and the senses can enjoy better, or get farther ahead, or get rich, or whatever it may be. But the purified intelligence is very different. Purified intelligence is the ability to discern between spirit and matter. This is the real job of the intelligence, to understand what is spiritual, what is material, and to make these distinctions. Say, this is actually good for me, this is not good for me. This is in my best interest. It is in my best interest to follow these principles or perform sadhana, to chant Hare Krishna, to read these books. Intelligence can make those discriminations. And when one begins to chant, the intelligence becomes more and more purified and helps to lead one further and further to better decisions that bring one further and further to spiritual life, so that one can make advancement in spiritual realization, in Krishna consciousness, and come more and more to the position of pure bhakti, pure servant of Krishna. So this purification is very important. We don't use the word so much, you know, in Western society. You know, purification sounds kind of puritanical or something, you know, but what does it really mean? It means we're becoming free or purified from You know, when something, you say, they use this word like something is pure. It's 100% pure, no adulterated, nothing added, right? So we mean becoming free, 100% free from the modes of nature. That's really what purified means, isn't it? You know, we become purified from the influence of the modes of nature. And when one is free from that influence, then one is influenced only by one's spiritual consciousness, by the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the spiritual master. So, I'm running out of time. Okay. So chanting is the key. Chanting Hare Krishna is the process of purification for Kali Yuga. It's a very powerful process, and even when we're in the beginning stages, has great effect. It's described as the three stages of chanting: the offensive stage, Namaparad, the clearing stage, Namabhasa, and the pure stage, the Shuddha Sattva stage. So we should be striving for at least the Namabhasa, the clearing stage, the middle stage, because that is very powerful in itself. Haridas Thakur, of course, gave a very famous speech in the assembly of devotees. He was challenged about the powers of the holy name, and because he said, even in this Namabhasa stage, one can gain immediate liberation. In fact, he said, Sridhanya Charitamrita, Anchalila 363, even a faint light from the holy name of the Lord can eradicate all the reactions of sinful life. So this power is there in the holy name. And of course, once one's reactions to sinful life are eradicated, that's not the end for the devotee. That's not really the goal. The real goal is to develop love of God, and that will come about. In a purport to 6.1.15, the story of Ajamil, Srila Prabhupada said, he's talking about this light from the rays of the sun of the holy name. He says, this is an example of Bhaskar, the sun is most appropriate. The Abhasa feature of bhakti, that's that clearing stage, or that the Namabhasa stage, is compared to twilight. And the accumulations of one's sinful activity is compared to fog. Since fog does not spread throughout the sky, the sun need do no more than merely manifest its first rays, and the fog immediately disappears. Similarly, if one has even a slight relationship with devotional service, all the fog of his sinful life is immediately vanquished. So this is a very wonderful process, very easy process. We simply begin the process by chanting the holy name of the Lord, hearing the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, these Vedic literatures, associate with devotees, come and see our wonderful, beautiful deities of the Lord, take prasadam in a few minutes, purified spiritual food, and through these processes, one is able to give up all those relationships with the three modes of material nature and come to the platform of devotional service, bhakti yoga. Okay, should probably stop at that time. Is there any discussion on these verses or any of the ideas? Yes, for Yamaraj? Yeah, let's use the microphone.
Okay, thank you for your very informative class. You know, since you're saying that this is such a simple and easy process, I believe that. But why is it that the majority of people don't want God?
Yeah, you know, it's you offer something very, you say this is very easy, very simple but sublime, but yet so many people will not take it. Prabhupada also gave the examples like selling diamonds. You know, if you sell some just trinkets, some cheap imitation jewelry down at Walmart, you know, for $3 or $5, you get a lot of takers. But you know, if you're selling diamonds, you don't get so many customers. So it's like that. It's the real thing. It's something that is of the greatest value, and not everybody can really appreciate it. Because it does require something. There is some small sacrifice, because one does have to engage at least a little bit in the surrendering process. of giving up one's false ego, giving up one's sense of I am the enjoyer, I am the controller, everything is mine, and have that attitude of surrender, of giving back to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, of service. No, people don't like that idea of service, do they? They're almost allergic to it. No one wants to be a servant. Everybody wants to be the master. So not everybody's ready for it because we've been conditioned in this material world for so long. No. But we're seeing that more and more people are really not finding answers in the material world. They're seeing that this isn't working well for them. And I think we're starting to see that there's more and more interest in spiritual life. There's real upsurge, I think, within, especially in America, we're seeing, you know, that people are interested in meditation and yoga and vegetarianism. They're interested in different ideas. They're interested in something beyond the materialistic solutions that they've received. So while not so many people want to buy the diamonds, I think we're going to see a lot more interest. You know, there's a lot more interest in diamond sales these days. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna, Prabhupada. I have a question regarding a relation between the mind and the intelligence. We often have a fight between the mind and the intelligence, and the outcome of the fight is a decision. And after a few months, we look back at the consequences of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
The consequences sometimes may be good, sometimes may be bad. So whom do we blame, the mind or the intelligence?
that's a great question. You know, yes, if the mind and intelligence are sort of like, you know, at odds, and one wins or the other wins, you know, usually if the intelligence wins, it's usually better than if the mind does. Because intelligence is a little bit higher, has more powers of discrimination, where the mind is really more of the reservoir of the senses. And, you know, but I guess one could say if the mind is always winning, then maybe you could say the intelligence is weak. So in that sense, you could blame the intelligence as well, because why is intelligence weak? Now, then we could ask, well, what makes intelligence strong so that it can make better decisions and be stronger than the mind? And what makes intelligence strong is spiritual practice, ultimately. Of course, even through material austerity, one can gain some strength of intelligence. I mean, we've seen that, right? Some people become very powerful and very strong just through austerity. But through spiritual practice, it's even better. Because then one has actual spiritual strength for the intelligence to be able to overcome the mind. You know, actually, it's very difficult to overcome the mind. Arjuna even said that, didn't he? What Arjuna says to Krishna, it's so difficult to overcome the mind. He said, it seems impossible to me. He said, Arjuna, great, great warrior, great devotee, said, it seems impossible. He said, it's like trying to control the raging wind, right? So what did Krishna say? Well, he didn't exactly give a definitive explanation, but he did say a very important thing. He said, it is possible by practice and detachment. I think if we expanded practice, it means spiritual practice, sadhana. Through our spiritual practice, one can control the mind, and detachment, having that sense of that we detach a little bit from the pushings of the senses. That's why we follow the four regular principles, for instance. We have, you know, our regular principles, no meat eating, no intoxication, no gambling, no illicit sex life. In other words, this is a type of detachment that keeps the pushings and the forces of our senses and our mind from taking over. So there's the detachment part, and in the practice, that's our sadhana, that's the hearing and chanting. And so those are the ways that we control the mind and strengthen the intelligence. Okay? Anything else? Go ahead. 1 second, we'll get the microphone. It's being broadcast, so we want to get the questions on.
So you mentioned that in the spiritual world there's unlimited variety, and in the material world there's also variety.
A lot of variety.
Is corrupted. How can there be no conflict arise then if there's so much variety and there's unlimited variety, and there still not be conflict?
There is conflict. right?
Spiritual world?
Well, the material variety and material enamorment and illusion is always conflict. You know, there's always a conflict. It's always pushing for our attention, right? In other words, you know, when we're in this material world, we're bombarded, aren't we? Particularly in this age. I mean, you go down the street and the billboards and the radio and the music, you know, everything. We're bombarded by inducements. You know, so yeah, there's always that conflict of which variety are we going to be attracted to, the material or the spiritual. You know, now when one is really situated in one's spiritual position, when one is, purified, then there's really not much competition. Then the material world seems very meaningless. One of the acharyas said that he described it, of course, a little bit quaint expression to us, but consider several hundred years ago. He said, the amount of enjoyment in this material world is like the amount of water in a calf's hoofprint compared to the ocean of devotional happiness.
But within the spiritual world, within the variety in the spiritual world, is there a conflict?
Is there a conflict? No, because everyone is perfectly situated. In the spiritual world, whatever our position is what we're supposed to be. It's who we are. So, in other words, if I'm a coward boy, or I'm a gopi, or I'm in a parental relationship, or whether I'm a tree, or whether I'm a cow, or whatever, that's exactly who I am, what I'm supposed to be, and so I'm happy. So there's no competition. In fact, Prabhupada explained, he said there is spiritual competition, but spiritual competition means, we just want to, look what nice service this devotee has done. I would like to do some nice service also. In other words, it doesn't have envy. That's the difference. In the material world, competition and conflict have some quality of envy. In the spiritual world, there's no envy, even when there's competition. There's competition amongst the gopis, but there's no envy. It's all on a pure platform. Thank you. That's a very good question. Appreciate it. Was there one more? Okay, it's 6 o'clock. I think it's time for Prasadam. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hari Bol.